I will call the Legislative Commission on Data Practices to order. We don't have a quorum here, so we can't approve the minutes from last time, but I appreciate everybody being here this morning on a beautiful June day. Just a little background first. Last session, a bill was brought forward to change parts of the Minnesota Health Records Act so that it would be in compliance with HIPAA laws for treatment, payment, and operations. And in the omnibus bill that was sent to the governor, there was language in there that our Data Practices Commission would take up that subject and study it. And as we know, the governor vetoed that bill. But I made promises to the bill's authors and leadership and several other folks that we would take up this issue, regardless of whether we were required to by some law. So that's why we're here this morning. And I appreciate our staff working hard to put a presentation together that addresses this subject. And we're kind of doing this is kind of the first part of the data. We'll be going over the first part of the data that that our researchers have been able to put together, because it's quite extensive. And so with that, I guess I will turn it over. Excuse me. We need to introduce our newest member first. Oh. Senator Claussen is our newest member of the Data Commission. And you raised your hand, Senator Claussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about what expectations for an outcome of our group might we be looking for?
Well, I think the first part of this is just going to be educating people on the background. And then my hope is that we can find some middle ground that helps address both the coordination of care, and that seems to be the primary push for making a change. And so I'm hoping that we can find some middle ground somewhere that works for everybody.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, you said that we were meeting or with the subject matter to be in compliance with HIPAA. I believe we are in compliance with HIPAA. HIPAA allows states to have stricter standards than the federal government. I don't think we're not in compliance, but there was a suggestion that we should be solely reliant on HIPAA for information to be passed from one facility to another.
If that was misconstrued, I just meant that there were sections of HIPAA that some of the stakeholders wanted us to move toward.
Yeah. Okay.
So, right. Senator Claussen.
So, Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, we would expect that we would be making some recommendations as a commission after
Yes. We
have a series of meetings.
Or yes.
Whatever. Okay. Thank you.
And look for probably a meeting a month during the interim on this subject. We have a quorum now. So with that, I'll go to our other sole House member. Representative Lucero, did you have time to review the minutes, or do you want to move those minutes from January 23rd?
I did, Madam Chair. So moved.
Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the approval of minutes of January 23rd, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Who will be going first? Mr. Hopkins? All right.
Madam Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins from the House Research Department. I've been asked to give a short presentation about Minnesota's Health Records Act and the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, or HIPAA. The goals of this presentation, this is just going to be a high-level overview. My goal is just to provide a baseline, impart some basic concepts and vocabulary to get everyone on the same page. It's not intended to be an exhaustive presentation of both laws. First, a little bit about the statutory background of both laws. The MHRA is Minnesota's state law, which governs access to and release of patient health records. The citation is Minnesota Statutes, Sections 144.291 to 298. The current version was passed in 2007. However, it was preceded by Section 144.335, and that was originally created back in 1977. However, the patient consent requirements of the MHRA, which are really the subject of the commission here today, were added to that section in 1991. And the really important point here is that that precedes HIPAA, which was passed in 1996. So In 1991, when Minnesota added that patient consent requirement to the MHRA, it was part of a patchwork of state laws that preceded the federal regulations in HIPAA. HIPAA is the federal law governing, among other things, the use and disclosure of patient health records. Among other things is important there. This is just, we're really just talking about one title of HIPAA. It's called the privacy rule. The regulations are at 45 CFR Part 164, Subpart E. HIPAA also includes, for instance, the security rule, which deals with how health records need to be stored and kept safe. But the commission's focus today is really on the privacy rule, which deals with disclosure and use of patient health records. And HIPAA was passed in 1996. The general rule for the MHRA, as well as for HIPAA, there's a lot of parallel here. The general rule for the MHRA is that you're not allowed to release patient health records unless you have patient consent or a specific authorization in state law. Now, that does not include HIPAA. A specific authorization in law does not include HIPAA currently. Just because you're allowed to release something under HIPAA doesn't mean you can release it without patient consent under the MHRA. Now, this gets to the idea of preemption, which I'll touch on later, but if for some reason a provider or hospital has to release something under HIPAA, if they have to release certain patient information to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under HIPAA, then they have to do that in order to comply with HIPAA. So that would be a specific authorization under the MHRA. They wouldn't be violating the MHRA by complying with HIPAA when they have to release something. The issue is that just because HIPAA says you're allowed to release something, even without patient consent, doesn't mean you can release it without patient consent under the MHRA. So the general rule under HIPAA is very similar. No disclosure of patient health information, protected health information, or PHI, that's the vocabulary word for HIPAA, except as permitted or required by HIPAA. So for both of these, we have a general rule which says that you don't release protected health information. You don't release health records. So the exceptions to this general rule are going to be the really important thing to pay attention to. And looking forward, the main idea here is that HIPAA exceptions are much more broad than the exceptions under the MHRA. Who must comply with the law? Under HIPAA, you have this idea, this word of covered entities. Covered entities have to comply with HIPAA. Covered entities include health plans, healthcare clearinghouses, and healthcare providers. So we're talking about doctors, we're talking about insurance companies, and also there's this idea of business associates under HIPAA. Business associates are companies with whom covered entities contract to perform activities that require the use or disclosure of PHI. So this could include billing, practice management, data analysis, legal services, accounting. These are not covered entities under HIPAA, but they are third parties that contract with covered entities to perform certain services that require them to get certain amounts of patient health information. Under the MHRA,
Senator Kent.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt. May I just ask for a clarification? Because I thought I heard you say two different things, so if I could just get to make sure, because I clearly missed something. You were saying that the healthcare providers are considered covered entities under HIPAA, but and I thought you were saying that business associates fall under that definition, and you went through the list of, like, accounting, legal, et cetera. Are they or are they not? I was confused by
Mr.
that.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Senator Kent, business associates are not covered entities.
Okay.
Covered entities are the main people that are responsible for complying with HIPAA, and business associates sort of fall under the covered entities, so they're secondarily responsible to
there. Thank you.
And so, Mr. Hopkins, if I might, that kind of begs the question then, are business associates, what parameters, since they're not covered entities under HIPAA, are business associates, they are addressed in HIPAA, though, and they have certain parameters around their what they can and cannot share, is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. HIPAA regulations provide for what a covered entity needs to put in their contract with a business associate regarding how PHI is handled and treated.
Okay. Great, go ahead.
The people that are responsible for complying with the MHRA are providers. Providers are anyone who service who furnishes a health care service, home care providers, health care facilities. So this is going to include doctors, nurses, and a variety of other health care providers that are regulated under state law. It also covers, of course, persons who receive health care records from a provider. So you might be an insurance company that receives health care records from a doctor, and that means that you are receiving health care records from a provider, so you must comply with the MHRA as well. So getting to the exceptions, the MHRA exceptions to the general rule that you need consent in order to disclose health records. You can disclose health records without patient consent in a medical emergency to other providers within a related healthcare entity, so within the same hospital, for instance, for treatment purposes. If a patient is deceased and releases for treatment of a surviving adult child of the patient, to record locator services, these are entities that tell that doctors can use to find out where certain records are, health records are. They're not disclosing the substance of the records under the MHRA. They're just saying that they have patient health records. So it allows doctors to look up a person and find out, okay, where do I have to go to ask where this person's health records are, so they can help get them all in the same place and coordinate care. Mental health records to law enforcement in cases of emergencies, and for external research, unless the patient opts out. There's an opportunity for patient opt-out for external research under the MHRA. HIPAA exceptions. And again, the main idea here, HIPAA exceptions are more broad than the MHRA. These are instances where a person can disclose protected health information without the patient's consent. And the three big ones for HIPAA are treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. So treatment, medical treatment, payment means billing for medical treatment, and healthcare operations includes a variety of things just in terms of the clinic or provider, hospital's own internal management. Those are the three main things under HIPAA that differentiate it from the MHRA. Those are the big three. The HIPAA also allows a provider or person to disclose protected health information for a variety of public interest and benefit reasons when it's required by law, public health activities, reporting certain things to the Department of Health and Human Services, certain law enforcement purposes, serious threats to health or safety. Again, research, it can also be disclosed for research purposes or for internal fundraising by the hospital. So say you got a cancer screening at Hospital X. Hospital X can reach out to you for their own internal purpose, fundraising purposes, and say, would you like to donate to our cancer foundation at that hospital? HIPAA does require authorization for, I think it's good to call this out separately because the HIPAA exceptions are so broad that it's almost more interesting to ask, well, when does HIPAA require you to get patient consent or patient authorization to disclose? Disclosure of psychotherapy notes. Patient authorization is required for disclosure of psychotherapy notes for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. So there's a differentiation that HIPAA makes between normal health records and psychotherapy notes. Also, marketing purposes or sale. You have to receive patient authorization in order to disclose protected health information for marketing purposes or sale.
Excuse me, Mr. Hopkins. Senator Limmer has a question.
Mr. Hopkins, under the separate category of HIPAA and how it treats authorization for disclosure of psychotherapy notes, how involved are psychotherapy notes? Is it everything that a physician or a psychoanalyst or a psychiatrist writes in personal notes as they're conducting counseling of an individual?
Mr. Hopkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes.
And how does MHRA handle the same category?
Mr. Hopkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I'm not positive, but I can get back to you on that if there's a differentiation in the MHRA. And of course, MHRA requires consent for disclosure of all health records, which would include psychotherapy notes. So in that sense, with regard to psychotherapy notes, HIPAA and MHRA are aligned in that both would require consent or authorization in order to disclose.
Right. Thank you.
Please proceed.
A key takeaway is that because HIPAA allows disclosure without patient consent for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, PHI can be shared more easily, subject to the minimum necessary requirement. I think I forgot to touch on this minimum necessary requirement. The minimum necessary requirement under HIPAA says that you should only disclose as much protected health information as is necessary to perform a certain function. So just because you can disclose protected health information for billing purposes or payment purposes under HIPAA doesn't mean that if I work in the billing office of a hospital, I have access to the entirety of a person's healthcare records. That's not the case. I don't need to see all of a person's healthcare records to send out bills. I just need to know what procedures they got and how much they cost. So under the minimum necessary requirement says that you should only disclose as much protected health information as is necessary for a person to perform whatever function, task, or job they need to perform. So that's a very important caveat to this general key takeaway that HIPAA allows PHI to be shared more easily.
And Mr. Hopkins, and I don't know if Ms. Bartle's going to get to this or not, but my understanding of the HIPAA rule in this regard is that each provider has their own policies and procedures as to how to determine what is the minimum necessary. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's not, because there can be so many different circumstances where the minimum necessary requirement applies, HIPAA does not spell out in significant detail what the minimum necessary is for every possible circumstance. So it is something that is guided by each provider's own internal policies, subject to enforcement and review and compliance by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hopkins, on the upper part of your panel number four, we talk about the treatment, payment, healthcare operations, but below that, there's also considerations for research and internal fundraising. First question is on research, does personal identifiable information, is that included in the research or is it in aggregate form?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, it can vary depending on the circumstances. There's a variety of rules and regulations in HIPAA regarding how an external researcher can go about getting authorization to receive healthcare information. And it could include identifying information or not. So, and the situations and the rules for each will vary and the procedures will vary depending on how much identifying information or if any identifying information an external researcher.
And if it is unidentifiable or if it is identifiable, according to HIPAA, they do not need to seek consent from the individual to pass that information on to some kind of researcher.
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily.
All right. And
Senator Lim.
I'm rather curious about internal fundraising. That's kind of been an area that we've kind of neglected to talk about in the legislature. Perhaps we don't focus on internal fundraising under MHRA. But under HIPAA, could you expand on how internal fundraising practices occur under HIPAA, perhaps in other states, or just your understanding of it? Am I assuming that the patient list becomes a fundraising source for some entity?
Mr. Hopkins.
So it's only for, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't have all the details in front of me. It's only for internal fundraising purposes, so it's not for... its sale and marketing is different than internal fundraising. So it would be, I think the example that I gave would be if you received a cancer screening at a hospital and they had your contact information and they knew that you received a cancer screening, they could contact you regarding fundraising for, say, a cancer foundation or to raise money for the hospital, something like that. And they wouldn't need your consent to send you that fundraising information.
You would need consent?
You would not need
consent. Is there an opportunity for a patient to say they do not want to be on a fundraising list, or are they, let's say if they didn't want to be in it, is there any way to stop that request coming to them all the time?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes. Under HIPAA, patients can additionally opt to restrict certain sharing of their healthcare information, including for fundraising purposes.
Would you consider that an opt-out, or is it an opt-in to be on that list for fundraising?
Mr. Hopkins.
Senator Limmer, that would be an opt-out sort of procedure. Because you're not required to get consent, it's not something that the patient has to opt into. The default rule is that they can contact you without your consent for internal fundraising purposes.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Hopkins, as a follow-up to Senator Limmer's question on research, I've got two questions. First of all, is your response to the release of personal information for research purposes the same or similar under MHRA as it is on the HIPAA regulations?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman. Yes, so the MHRA does allow information to be disclosed for research purposes as well, unless the patient opts out. So there's very different regulations in terms of that, and I can follow up with more detail to the entire commission if they're interested more in the specific topic. But both do allow research personal health information to be shared for research purposes unless a patient opts out.
Mr. Newman. Or excuse me, Senator Newman, I was just going to make a little personal comment here, is that I think that's a weakness of the Minnesota Health Records Act, and I think that needs to be changed. But yeah, I know you had another question.
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hopkins, my second question, under the category of research, both for purposes of HIPAA and MHRA, are there any parameters or criteria which qualify folks or entities to receive this information for research purposes?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman. So under the MHRA, this is section 144.295. So it requires the records to be released only for purposes of medical or scientific research. It doesn't get any more specific than that. It does require the researchers to make reasonable efforts to ensure that the information is kept safe, that any use of disclosure in individually identifiable form is necessary to accomplish the research, but it doesn't require any specific qualifications for the researcher. It just says for purposes of medical or scientific research. So it's not as if you have to be affiliated with a certain kind of institution or have a certain kind of credential in order to be a researcher.
Madam Chair, just a comment.
Yes, Senator Newman.
I would think that entities such as Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota would certainly qualify. But if you had an individual, for instance, puts together an LLC claiming to be a researcher and is going to have access to the personal information, given the fact that there isn't any statutory criteria establishing the qualifications, maybe that would also be a weakness in both HIPAA and MHRA.
I would concur.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffman, going back to your internal fundraising comments, we're really talking about directory information. Can you elaborate on how directory information then can or cannot be shared on a general basis?
Madam Chair, Senator, so a hospital will routinely put together directory information that's shared, and they can rely on a patient's just verbal consent that they are okay with that. That is directory information of that kind, just who you are, that you're admitted, that you're a patient there. In a hospital is not as closely protected as the substance of your actual health records.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a scenario, a hospital could sell directory information to interested parties.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not sure about that because HIPAA does have that restriction on sale or marketing of personal health information, and I'm not sure if directory information, which would be, which we're sort of, I imagine we're talking about just the person's patient's name, maybe their mailing address. I'm not sure if that is covered under that marketing and sale restriction that HIPAA has, or if it would be something that could be disclosed without patient consent. But generally speaking, HIPAA does have that restriction on the sale and marketing of protected health information. It seems like the question here, which I'm not sure of the answer of, frankly, is whether or not just the name or a name and an email address, phone number, maybe address, constitutes protected health information for purposes of that sale and marketing restriction. I would be happy to follow up on that.
That would be great. All right, Mr. Hopkins, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this the conversation taking place here in regards to research and the transfer of information to research facilities or companies or organizations reminds me of the conversation that was had in the Education Policy Committee several years back on the topic of student information and the Minnesota Department of Education transferring that to researchers for research purposes. And one of the questions I asked back then was, when protected information is transferred to research organizations, what mechanisms exist to audit to ensure that those organizations are in compliance with the requirements of protecting information? And then if there is a breach, what requirements exist to notify those who might be impacted? So taking that, and back then the question or the answer from MDE was they hadn't performed audits in at least 10 years. So in this context, I could imagine that research organizations might not be healthcare organizations. They would be research organizations performing research on healthcare-related information. But the organizations themselves are not healthcare organizations. So does HIPAA or the Minnesota requirements have any process for auditing when PHI or PII is transferred to these researchers to ensure that they're in compliance? Because the word reasonable always causes me to cringe. Reasonable requirements to protect is so subjective. And then if when this information PHI, which has not been de-identified, so information that is identifiable, is transferred to researchers, and it is compromised, is there requirements that those that are impacted would be notified, as they would be if they were compromised in the systems of healthcare organizations?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero. So I'm not sure if researchers So the HIPAA is enforced by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights. An individual who is concerned that their PHI might be compromised can file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights, which then investigates. I don't know if they investigate researchers or if they just investigate covered entities. I'd be happy to find that out for you. I know that under HIPAA, recently there was some additions to HIPAA. It's called the High Tech Act. I believe it was in 2013, which covers breach notifications for healthcare information for covered entities. And I can also find out for you if those kinds of breach notification rules also apply to researchers as well as covered entities themselves.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you just referenced what I was going to get to at the end of your presentation, but since you just brought up high tech, I might as well bring it up. So, as you're talking here and comparing HIPAA to MHRA, I imagine a Venn diagram with, you know, each MHRA and HIPAA represented by ovals, and they overlap in a certain portion. In your presentation that you've prepared, at least there isn't anything in here about high tech. And is that because high tech doesn't overlap or isn't applicable in this case, or is it just because this is a higher level summary that you're preparing that high tech might be applicable? And for those who don't know high tech, the acronym HITECH stands for Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act. And so just a brief two sentences here. HIPAA and HITECH rules are often discussed together for a number of reasons, and it makes sense because One is meant to be the extension of the other. However, HIPAA was developed before the days of ubiquitous technology, meaning that it, HIPAA, wasn't properly accounting for regulating patient privacy when it came to keeping electronic records. So HIPAA, the origin of HIPAA goes back to President Clinton's, the days of President Clinton, you know, back when patient records were much more paper-based, and then high-tech was implemented when things became more electronic-based. So anyway, question on the high-tech and the absence of that in this presentation.
Yeah. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, that's right. Primarily what this presentation is very high level, and it's primarily covering just the privacy rule, which deals with when information can be disclosed with or without consent. High-tech, the key part of it, as you touched on, is a lot about securing patient health information and what to do in the case of a breach or unauthorized disclosure of information, the notification procedures that are a part of that. That's not something that's in the MHRA. So that is a disconnect between HIPAA and the MHRA again. High-tech and the breach notification procedures seem to me to fall more sort of in line with the original 1996 HIPAA's security rule rather than its privacy rule, dealing with how to keep patient health information safe and secure rather than when and when it can't be shared.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. And just one last comment then. So for members and for everybody listening, if this topic weren't complex enough with MHRA and HIPAA, I'm adding in a example Venn diagram here, a third oval that would overlap with high tech and the potential implications. And as we continue these conversations, just be cognizant of an even more complex topic. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I know I think some of this may be on your Venn diagram. Also, you layer over the Affordable Care Act and the electronic health records piece and how that is also a part of this conversation. And but we will get back to the presentation. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, also a key question is how are these laws enforced? And there's a pretty significant disconnect between MHRA and HIPAA on the enforcement side. MHRA provides a private right of action for a patient whose information is disclosed in violation of the MHRA. It allows that patient to basically sue the provider person that violated the MHRA in order to seek compensatory damages. And there's also a provision that allows for attorney's fees there. And the MHRA can also be enforced through disciplinary actions by the licensing board for the healthcare provider. HIPAA, in contrast, does not provide a private right of action. An individual whose healthcare information is disclosed in violation of HIPAA does not have the right to sue for that under HIPAA itself. Some state courts have found that there can be just a general negligence claim that a person can have if their information is released in violation of HIPAA, but it's not a specific lawsuit under HIPAA itself. Instead, HIPAA is enforced primarily by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights. They can receive complaints from individuals, perform investigations, enter into settlement agreements, or just they could perform an investigation and find out that the agency is in compliance or ask the agency to change certain procedures in order to come into compliance. They can also give out civil penalties to covered entities. The statutory maximum is $1.5 million in penalties per violation category per year.
Can I stop you there? And could you elaborate on that a little bit? So if a provider, best health company, if they have a massive violation where, thousands of people's information is compromised, the maximum that it would be an aggregate number there. So 1.5 million per occurrence. So not one individual can't collect 1.5 million. It's everybody whose information was breached.
Madam Chair, so the individual whose information is breached is not collecting any money. under this. The fees are collected by the Department of Health and Human Services, and it's per violation category, not per instance. Okay. So you could have multiple instances of the same kind of violation, but we aren't counting. The $1.5 million is per violation category. So if you have multiple violations of a certain kind, it goes up to $1.5 million for that kind of violation.
So where does the award money go?
I'm not... It's
collected by the government?
Yes, the federal government collects the civil fine amount. I'm not sure what is done with it, if it's put in some kind of special account, but I can find that out for you.
Terrific. Thank you.
The Office of Civil Rights can also refer a case to the Department of Justice for criminal penalties. The most severe criminal penalties that can be given out under HIPAA are up to 10 years in jail. That's for stealing PHI for malicious purposes. So for instance, if somebody wants to steal PHI and sell it in violation of HIPAA, that can be punishable by up to 10 years in jail. Also, state attorneys general, this is fairly recent, I think it started in 2009, are now authorized to bring civil actions on behalf of state residents, and this has occurred in Minnesota. So a state attorney general is also empowered to enforce HIPAA.
Mr. Hopkins, one thing that I, in my reading, is that it's really hard for a person who's been violated to really recover anything because... they were, if they think their health information has been improperly shared, because they're by being part of HIPAA and they're seen as having given permission for all their information to be shared, and so it's really hard for them to form a case of any violation because they were seen as being compliant with giving their in the sharing of their information. See what I'm getting at?
Yes, Madam Chair. So if there's no private right of action under HIPAA, so there really is no ability for an individual to bring a lawsuit to recover any damages that they might have suffered as a result of the disclosure of healthcare information, it's not possible for them to bring a lawsuit under HIPAA to recover themselves. That is a key difference between HIPAA and the MHRA. The MHRA has that private right of action. So if you can show that you were damaged somehow because your health records were released in violation of the MHRA, you have the ability under Minnesota law to go to court and to sue that person that violated the MHRA in order to get that money back and be made whole.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Hopkins, in the event that a corporation violated the law, the HIPAA law, would a criminal charge be filed against a corporation, or would it be the president of a corporation, or would it be an individual actually seeking the information? How would that work?
Mr. Hopkins.
If it's done by a corporation.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, so most of the time with criminal charges, you're dealing with specific actors within that agency. So instances where you might have a criminal penalty under HIPAA would be if someone within the organization stole health records in order to sell them to on the black market, like as an identity theft kind of situation. You can't put a corporation in jail, but you can jail an individual. So the civil fines are really the main deterrent for organizations and corporations.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to bring up the examples being used are theft and things like that. But earlier on in my career, one of the organizations I worked for in a cybersecurity capacity was a health insurance company here in Minnesota organization. And one of the more common occurrences of a data compromise was a theft of laptop. And so you could imagine there are employees of the organization, depending on their role, it might be that they aren't directly interacting with massive amounts of PHI or PII, but because they have email, It's very common for a patient's name or any portion of address and other protected information to be in an email, which in an email, then it's going to be on the hard drive. And if those laptops are left due to negligence or other variables, stolen from the backseat of the car, stolen from a trunk, it becomes now the liability of that organization to notify the patients of their information being compromised or potentially being compromised. And so, again, that was a much more a common occurrence. And it causes great concern for me if I'm hearing that under HIPAA, if that were to occur, there is less recourse for an individual whose information may have been compromised and leaving it up to the federal government to take action versus current Minnesota law under MHRA to be able to take action themselves. So, again, that's a much more tangible and common occurrence. And even to this day, I'm amazed at how many laptops and mobile devices that contain PHI or PII that aren't encrypted. So when they're stolen, it creates a huge heartache. So thank you, Madam Chair.
I know in my file here somewhere, I do have an article that talks about the value of a person's health information on the dark web and in the black market, and it's actually worth more than your Social Security number and name and birth date and all those things. So this is really valuable information to be putting out there. So, Mr. Hopkins, go ahead.
I touched on this a little, Madam Chair, I touched on this a little bit earlier in the presentation, this idea of preemption. So HIPAA does not preempt the MHRA. The general statutory rule is that HIPAA is going to supersede or preempt any contrary provision of state law. Provisions of state law are only contrary to HIPAA if it would be impossible for a healthcare provider to conform and comply with both the MHRA and HIPAA. So because the MHRA is more restrictive in terms of when it requires consent and HIPAA is more permissive, it is possible for a provider in Minnesota to comply with both MHRA and HIPAA. So that's the reason that HIPAA does not preempt MHRA state law. You can think of it as the MHRA is setting HIPAA is setting a floor, but not a ceiling in terms of protecting patient health information. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on some general policy considerations that legislators can keep in mind when considering this topic. You could look at it as two sides of a scale. On one side, you have a concern for privacy, people wanting to keep their health information as private as possible, and also a concern for patient autonomy, patients being able to control what happens to their own health information. On the other side of the scale, convenience and efficiency, both for patients. Some patients might believe that it's more convenient for them to be able to move from state to state and see different providers in different hospital systems and have their information shared without having to sign a bunch of forms. And also for the providers themselves, for care coordination, they might find it easier to be able to access protected health information more easily without having to get a lot of forms signed. Other policy considerations are health outcomes, what generates the best health outcomes for individuals and at the population level, and also administrative costs. How do we reduce administrative costs? Some questions to ask are, what do patients want? What do patients expect? Do they expect to be able to go from doctor to doctor, hospital system to hospital system, and have their information shared easily and automatically? Or do they expect that their information won't be shared unless they specifically agree to it? So you have these countervailing values of privacy and autonomy versus convenience and efficiency for patients. Another question is, what do providers want? What do doctors and healthcare systems want? What produces the best health outcomes, both at the individual level and at the population level? What reduces red tape and administrative costs? And what encourages innovation in healthcare delivery? So these are just some general questions and ideas to keep in mind when considering this topic in the future. And if anyone has any other questions, I'd be happy to do my best to answer.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hopkins, for that overview. Ms. Bartle.
Madam Chair, just one moment. I'm going to get my presentation up for you. Madam Chair and members, good morning. My name is Maren Bartle. I am the Research Assistant for the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. Today I will be presenting on healthcare records, how they affect coordination of care and state policies addressing healthcare records. To begin, coordination of care is a fundamental aspect of health records. However, it's often complex and often involves changing parts and definitions. As you can see on this slide, there's no universal definition for coordination of care. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has used the following definition: the deliberate organization of patient care activities between two or more participants involved in a patient's care to facilitate the appropriate delivery of health services. Organizing care involves the marshaling of personnel and other resources needed to carry out all required patient care activities and is often managed by the exchange of information among participants responsible for different aspects of care. Throughout the process of coordinating a patient's care, the use and disclosure of the patient's health records often becomes a problem. The primary problem occurs while exchanging information during points of transition. Points of transition include exchanging information between multiple covered entities throughout the process of the patient's care, and exchanging information over a large span of time, either within the same covered entity or among multiple entities. Most often, a breakdown in the coordination of care occurs when patients, professionals, or system representatives experience a barrier that prevents them from exchanging information easily. As you'll see, the patients, professionals, and system representatives will experience this breakdown differently among one another. Patients have been known to believe that this breakdown occurs when they have to exert more effort than they feel is reasonably necessary to exchange their information among healthcare providers or covered entities. Healthcare professionals believe that the breakdown in coordination of care is experienced if there are delays or refusals to exchange information. System representatives, like IT professionals handling the healthcare systems, believe that a breakdown in coordination of care occurs when the systems are not functioning as they should, or their systems are not adaptable to changes in definitions and laws. Some barriers in exchanging information are the state and federal laws that are designed to protect healthcare records and patient privacy. This includes Minnesota Health Records Act and HIPAA. HIPAA's privacy rules allows for the exchange of information without patient consent for the purpose of treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. These exceptions to consent are meant to streamline coordination of care, but often due to the complexities of HIPAA, it sometimes further complicates and confuses the coordination of care. On the other hand, there are stringent state laws, like the Minnesota Health Records Act, that do not allow for exceptions to consent that are similar to HIPAA. As a result, stringent state laws may slow or prohibit the exchange of information unless there is patient consent. So it can be argued that Minnesota Health Records Act is a barrier in the exchange of information. However, some research has suggested that the Minnesota Health Records Act does not, in fact, hinder coordination of care or the exchange of information. The IBM Watson Study of Health Systems evaluated nationwide 338 health systems and 2,422 health system member hospitals. This evaluation was based on public data available to them, which included patient satisfaction data from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Across the nation, the Mayo Clinic ranked in the top five of the large health systems. Health Partners ranked in the top five of the medium-sized health systems. This information would suggest, since it's based on patient satisfaction, that patients didn't experience a breakdown in coordination of care within Minnesota due to the Minnesota Health Records Act, as two of our hospitals are in the top five. Additionally, according to the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, on average, 76% of hospitals have the capability to exchange a summary of care records with outside providers. This next graphic will show the averages for, the percentage of hospitals that can exchange the summary of care records across the United States with outside providers. As you'll see, the national average, or you might not see because it's so small, sorry, the national average is 76%. Minnesota has an average of 73% of hospitals that can provide summary of care records with any outside provider using their IT systems. There's other states, South Dakota, which is as low as 51%, and other states like Florida that are high as 94%. So obviously Minnesota being at 73% falls in the middle of these.
Ms. Bartle?
Yes.
Does South Dakota, you said that was the one that was the really low one right there. I think I can see it there.
Correct.
Do they have any laws that are stricter than HIPAA?
Madam Chair, offhand, I'm not sure, but I believe that I have that answered in here. One moment. Okay. There does not appear to be any laws that are stricter than HIPAA in South Dakota.
Thank you.
Next, we should consider whether HIPAA is a barrier to the exchange of information. This was discussed in great detail at a 2013 congressional hearing, which I plan to just show you the three clips from that hearing, because I think as the medical professionals that testify can better understand and present these issues that HIPAA causes in the exchange of information. So first is the testimony of Mr. Mark Rothstein. He is the Director of Healthcare Policy and Law at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. And he is highlighting the complexities of HIPAA that sometimes hinder healthcare professionals' ability to understand and easily exchange information.
Research and education programs have led to a lack of understanding of the...
One moment.
Rule. Third, for the last 10 years, inadequate health professional and patient outreach and education programs have led to a lack of understanding of the privacy rule by many affected individuals and covered entities. A common problem is that some uses and disclosures permitted by the privacy rule are not allowed by some covered entities, perhaps out of ignorance or an overabundance of caution.
Mr. Rothstein did suggest at this congressional hearing that additional efforts were needed to increase the understanding of the privacy rule for the public and covered entities, and he believed that this would help enhance the effectiveness of the privacy rule. Next, there is testimony from Dr. Cassidy. He is a former representative, and he was also, I believe, still is a practicing physician. He just highlights the threat and fear of liability that physicians face when dealing with HIPAA.
Chairman Murphy, gentlemen, I am a practicing physician. We'll see patients this Tuesday morning. And I have a sense that you two are incredibly bright and well-versed in this law, and is totally divorced from the reality of an ER physician seeing 20 patients in a shift, and at 3 a.m. there's a person who comes in with these issues. I'll just tell you. And I'll also tell you that physicians fear the federal government. They understand that if the federal government comes after them and grabs them in their long legal arm, the physician may ultimately win, but she is destroyed in the process. Now, I listen to what you say, how this would be allow certain forms of communication. But I will also say, when I read that the maximum penalty is $1.5 million, when the physician is having their in-service on HIPAA, that's what they remember. And when they understand that, listen, it is permissible not to give information, but you may get in trouble if you do, I can tell you, that guy, that gal seeing the patient at 3 a.m. with 20 patients doesn't have your expertise, but what they do have are examples of physicians who have been grabbed by the law and not let loose until every one of their personal resources have been exhausted.
Lastly, there's testimony from Dr. Gingray responding to Mr. Rothstein about the concerns that professionals may actually be hiding behind HIPAA that allows them, and so they're allowing themselves to only speak to patients and aren't actually speaking to family members or other third parties that might be entitled to access the information under HIPAA.
But HIPAA is a very misunderstood regulation. It's misunderstood by the public. It's misunderstood by healthcare providers. And
well, let me interrupt you to say that I fully agree with you. And as a practicing physician for a long time before coming here 10 years ago, I knew that. I wonder if some physicians don't hide behind HIPAA just to move on to the next patient and not want to be bothered with or an uncle or a cousin or, you know, in regard to questions about their loved one. I hope that doesn't exist too much, but, I mean, it's something that we need to think about. Let me go back to...
One moment, sorry. This testimony is important because it's been suggested that eliminating the Minnesota Health Records Act and replacing it with HIPAA guidelines will streamline the coordination of care. However, this testimony demonstrates that adopting HIPAA does not necessarily alleviate these issues and may even further complicate things. In addition to complicating the law, eliminating Minnesota Health Records Act will affect patient privacy in four important ways. First, patient consent would no longer be required in order to disclose a patient's PHI for the purpose of treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, under which Mr. Hopkins touched on. Under HIPAA's privacy rule, disclosures are allowed without patient consent for the purpose of treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. As Mr. Hopkins outlined, under HIPAA, disclosures without patient consent are limited by the minimum necessary standard. However, it's important to note that the minimum necessary standard only applies to disclosures for the purpose of payment and healthcare operations. The minimum necessary standard requires a covered entity to limit the use, disclosure, and requests for PHI to the minimum necessary information needed to accomplish the intended purpose. As we previously discussed, the minimum necessary standard is based on what is reasonable. This is the reasonably necessary standard, so it is up to the covered entity to determine what PHI is reasonably necessary for a particular purpose, given the characteristics of their business and workforce, and requires covered entities to implement those policies and procedures accordingly. A very important exception to the minimum necessary rule is that disclosures for the purpose of treatment are not limited by the minimum necessary standard. Not limiting treatment disclosures allows arguably anyone to the involved in the coordination of care to exchange a patient's protected health information. This includes healthcare providers, business associates, and their subcontractors. This is problematic because patients cannot prohibit or control disclosures of their PHI to anyone under this treatment exception. Furthermore, under 45 CFR section 164.522A, patients do have a right to request a covered entity to restrict the use or disclosure of their PHI. However, the covered entity is not required to agree to such a request or restriction. Therefore, eliminating the Minnesota Health Records Act and implementing HIPAA would further prohibit patients from requesting restrictions to their access to their PHI. A third privacy concern is that patients' consent would no longer be required to use PHI for external research purposes. As we previously discussed, currently under Minnesota statute section 144.295, providers must provide patients the opportunity to object to their records being released for the purpose of research. HIPAA allows covered entities to use this PHI without a patient's consent for the purpose of research, so long as it's de-identified. Lastly, if the Minnesota Health Records Act was eliminated, Minnesotans would lose their right to private action. I know we already discussed this with Mr. Hopkins' presentation, but under HIPAA, again, there is no private right to action, so no one would be able to file a lawsuit alleging violations of HIPAA. Instead, a victim must either file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights or rely on their Attorney General to bring a civil action. Another important note is that patients may file a lawsuit alleging any violation of, invasion of privacy under a tort. However, that places a burden on the patient to proving either defamation of character, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and a plethora of other things. So under state law, the most reasonable recourse for a patient would be to pursue private action. Unfortunately, there are several problems with filing OCR complaints. First, that small-scale violations are typically not investigated, and the violator may be terminated, but often the provider faces no punishment by the Office of Civil Rights. So I don't know if you'll be able to read that, but below is one example of many examples. A woman's son's attempted suicide record was compromised by someone within the healthcare entity, and it was shared among his school members, and which led to his bullying, which he previously did not experience. The only way that this woman had any recourse was to file a lawsuit alleging an invasion of privacy, and has to meet more difficult burdens of proof in the court of law rather than pursuing an Office of Civil Rights complaint process, because she did not feel that she would experience the and gain the remedies that she desired. The second problem with the OCR complaint process is that even large-scale and consistent violations do not always result in sanctions. For example, Veterans Affairs from 2011 to 2014 violated HIPAA 220 times. Some examples include a wife checking her ex-husband's records over 260 times, an employee searching a patient's record over 61 times and then posting those details on Facebook, and an employee providing patient health information to their parole officer. The VA did not receive public reprimand or any sanctions for these violations. Instead, they were given corrective action plans or provided technical assistance by the OCR on how to comply with HIPAA. While it is good, obviously, to provide technical assistance with HIPAA compliance, it does not necessarily prevent future violations. So lastly, I would like to give a brief overview on some state policies concerning health records.
Ms. Bartle, before we get to that, Representative Lucero has a question.
Thank you. So I just want to make sure I'm entirely clear and in my understanding. So you just finished the section of, it looks like there were six slides, what happens if Minnesota eliminates the MHRA? So Chair Scott referenced a proposal near the end of the legislative session that it would repeal the MHRA in its entirety.
Correct.
But it would repeal significant portions of it, is my understanding. So I don't know all the details, but
it would not require consent for treatment, payment, or operations.
For operations, which would include coordinating care, right? Okay, so it's my understanding then of just the several conversations that occurred at the end of session there on that proposed language, that one of the drivers for that was because MHRA is currently interfering and slowing down coordinating of care, and it's increasing the cost. I think one of the numbers I heard was like $600 million.
Over 10 years.
So on average $60 million a year, right? That the MHRA is creating in terms of increased costs. But when I look at then the map that you discussed earlier here, I'm seeing that there are other states that obviously don't have the MHRA that are relying on HIPAA only that have a much lower percentage than Minnesota, 73%. So based on your significant research on this topic and this, then would you say that the claims or the driver that the MHRA is creating additional costs and is significantly interfering with the coordinating of care are not correct or maybe are exaggerated?
Ms. Bartle.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, I guess I'm not comfortable weighing in on what the effect on cost the MHRA has. I would say as far as the coordination of care, based on the map that we were discussing, I can go back to that, that there are circumstances in which the MHRA has not impeded the coordination of care. This being one of them, this is the percentage of hospitals that can provide a care summary to any outside provider. So that doesn't include an entire medical record. That's only a care summary. So of course, there aren't statistics available that I know of that would show how Minnesota is performing in comparison to other states in regards to the entire medical record and the ability to share that with outside providers. This is just the summary of care record. Does that answer your question?
Representative Lucero.
It almost does, and I to the degree that it's possible today. And so I just want clarification of that, because obviously this is a driver for any changes, right? And those are some of the claims that we heard. So I will qualify my previous statements in with the following, and that is, when I look at Mr. Hopkins' research here, the MHRA dates back to its origination in 1977. Within changes, it appears in maybe 1991 and 2007 and perhaps a few others. So I qualify those statements with, given that the MHRA goes back to the 70s, we definitely need to review it to ensure that, I have no doubt that there are many opportunities to increase efficiencies, lower costs that are being increasing on providers and others in the industry, but at the same time, I want to ensure that the driver for any changes, those claims are also obviously accurate. So, thank you,
Ms. Bartle.
Thank you. Okay, so lastly, I'd like to give you a brief overview of some state policies concerning health records. As I mentioned, it's important to note that most states do have adopted HIPAA or laws that mimic HIPAA. So I only plan to touch on a few states that differ from HIPAA. First is California's Confidentiality of Medical Information Act. Privacy right organizations, including privacyrights.org, alleges that this act provides more privacy protection than HIPAA. However, like many states, California provides for the same exceptions to consent as HIPAA. So it's important to note that even in situations where acts allege that they provide more protection than HIPAA, they often do not due to their exceptions to consent. Next is Florida, which has a unique it differentiates from HIPAA just slightly in that the law allows for disclosures without patient consent only for the purpose of treatment. This means that there's no exception to consent for the purpose of payment or healthcare operations. There's a plethora of states that actually have adopted only certain aspects of HIPAA and have chosen not to adopt others. So this is just one that highlights that. Next is the good faith exception that is found in Georgia law, and this is concerning liability for healthcare providers. It states that any provider or person who, in good faith, releases copies or medical records in accordance with this code shall not be found to have violated any criminal law or to be civilly liable to the patient, the deceased patient's estate, or to any other person. This, of course, addresses and hopefully remedies the concern that was brought up in several of the physicians' testimony that I shared earlier. Next, I outlined Maryland's criminal penalties. There are a few other states with similar criminal penalties, but I believe that Maryland does have some of the highest criminal penalties. Maryland law generally follows HIPAA, But when there is a wrongful disclosure or a wrongful obtaining of medical records, it is punishable as a misdemeanor for a knowing and willful violation. This is punishable by imprisonment up to 1 year and or fines of up to $50,000. The penalties in Maryland will increase if the disclosure is made under false pretenses or the disclosure is done with the intent to sell, transfer, or use commercial advantage, personal gain, or malicious harm. Next, we have the Massachusetts Patch Act, which was just recently signed by their governor. It focuses on the privacy of medical records throughout the payment process. This primarily protects adult dependents who are still on their parents' health care plan. It allows for patients to provide and select a physical and email address that are separate from the policyholders. Patients can also opt out of receiving payment forms if money is not due. And then we have Rhode Island's Confidentiality of Healthcare Communications and Information Act. It allows for the disclosure of medical records without patient consent for the purpose of treatment in emergency circumstances and requires that all requests be made in good faith. So that in that aspect, it does kind of incorporate Georgia's good faith exception, which helps, of course, with the physician liability issue. It also provides that any person who violates the act can be liable for actual punitive damages plus reasonable attorney fees and may face criminal charges. So built in there is the private right of action that you won't see available to patients under HIPAA. Third, it outlines certain security requirements for third parties receiving medical records. So earlier in Mr. Hopkins' presentation, when we were discussing requirements under high tech, I'm not sure, but I can look into if this outlines additional security requirements for business associates and their independent contractors. Fourth, this law outlines the requirements of consent forms that are needed for the release or transfer of medical records. So this would be similar to the consent form under Minnesota Health Records Act. Lastly is South Carolina's Physician-Patient Records Act, which allows a physician the right to refuse to release a copy of the patient's entire medical record in circumstances where release is otherwise prohibited by law, and allows a physician to instead provide a summary or portion of the record. So this allows for physicians to provide what they feel is necessary to assist in the treatment of patients without having to provide by law the entire record or satisfy a request for an entire record. And that is the end of my presentation. I am available for questions.
Are there member questions? This information. Welcome, Representative Lesh. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If there are no member questions, I wasn't planning on taking any public testimony today because I thought that member questions and so forth would take up time. Senator Kent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any questions for this immediate presentation, but I did just want to ask a couple questions about the process, and I think that's what you were getting ready to jump into. So not planning on taking any testimony today, but you mentioned we're going to be meeting monthly for the rest of interim. Is it going to be focusing on this particular topic, or are we going to be doing additional subjects? What's the plan here?
I think given the complexity of this topic, it's probably going to take the remainder of the interim to take this issue up. I do want to have something that we can report back to the legislature on this, and I want it to be, you know, a thorough discussion here. And this is a complicated subject, and I appreciate the indulgence of all the members here. It takes a little bit of outside work to understand it fully. My plan for the next meeting was to have the second part of the information presented that Ms. Bartles has come up with, and then take public testimony and hear from the health plans and the advocates for making the change and moving on from there. So I don't know. I know there's one person that is asked to testify today. Mr. Heller's asked to testify. I don't know if there's anybody else even in the audience that's prepared to do so.
As a follow-up then, will we be going over the bills that were introduced this past session as a part of this conversation, or?
We could certainly do that.
I'm just curious how that, part of my confusion, and I think Representative Lucero was getting at this, is, you know, we just saw a whole discussion about what happens if we eliminate the MHRA. I'm not aware of any proposals, and that was part of my confusion. So it's hard to have these kinds of discussions sort of in the abstract, you know, if there are specific proposals being made. I think it's helpful to try to focus our conversation on what's realistically being discussed and considered.
Right, right. And it comes down to the treatment, payment, and operations piece. And so, yeah, the entire Minnesota Health Records Act would not go away, but the consent requirement to have the information shared would go away for treatment, payment, and operations. So that's what the bill basically says. I've got that right, Representative Zerwas, don't I? So we could certainly have a presentation, actually, absolutely, on the bill, and that's part of having the advocates come and present, you know, why they want to do this. Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, as we begin to look forward to testifiers regarding changing the law, as was stated this last year, I would appreciate it if they would provide some kind of definition of what coordination of care means to them. As we learned today, there doesn't seem to be a definition in federal law or in state law. So that would be a foundation to start with regarding what their version of coordination of care is, what their definition of a breakdown of that coordination of care would also be helpful. So just a fair warning to those that are advocating for change to start on a definitional basis first, and then we can start to analyze how everything is interconnected here and then how it interconnects with existing MHRA regulations.
And why don't, if members have questions that they'd like the answers to on this subject matter, why don't you send them to Sally, and then we will reach out to the advocates and have them see if they can provide those answers for us. I know one of the questions that I have is in the minimum necessary amount of information that's shared, and if each entity, you know, Allina, Health Partners, all those folks have different policies and procedures for defining that, defining what the minimum necessary is. I would certainly like to see some of those policies, and so that we have a better idea of what we're dealing with. So, if there are other things that have spurred your interest here and questions that you have, that would be good to get those questions to Sally, and we'll try to find the answers to them. Oh, one of the reasons that I wanted to get this information presented is because I didn't know how long we had Ms. Bartle. She's a part-time employee, and I just wanted to make sure that if she had to leave, that we got this information that she'd been working on, give her the opportunity to present it. But my understanding is now that she's going to be able to be here till the end of the year, unless she finds a grander opportunity, which I can't imagine that happening. But so that's great. We do have still have her for a resource so that we don't have to do all the legwork on this. So any other questions? Other than Mr. Heller, was there anyone in the audience that came prepared today to present anything or provide public testimony? All right. We'll go ahead and allow Mr. Heller. Thank you to our staff for a good presentation. And if you want to keep your comments just to this subject of the Minnesota Health Records Act and HIPAA, that would be appreciated, Mr. Heller. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chair. At the at this meeting today at the Legislative Commission Data Practice Committee, my name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional and people with print disabilities. Frankly, I've reviewed the documents online, so I like to come prepared at least to have been exposed to the printed word. Just for the record, the handles I provided you today, the website was analyzed. the Hiller documents found online. That's the yellow sheet on the back. Using the web check, there's a screenshot there. I'd ask that that be posted online only because I'm a firm believer in health literacy. And health literacy relates to this as well, I believe. And I believe discussion today does not reflect health literacy. However, if you would go to one of your handouts, the 33-page one, on the questions and answers, page 26, under the last paragraph. So it's page 26, I guess. I said the website for the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, the ONC, suggests that making health records electronic and accessible. So is there separate on the National Health Exchange? I'll stop there because so far the legislature is not accessible based on Minnesota Statute 16E.03 subdivision 9. On the back, the correspondence I sent 5 minutes past the hour after this meeting started, you'll find that there was a bill introduced, Senate File 4116. It's full for authors. It relates to a prior bill, 1541 and 2120, that asked the legislature to make stuff more accessible and timely transparency for everybody. If you want the full audience involved here, I suggest that you, since Mary Hartnett spoke, the Deafblind Commission, spoke with Greg with the LCC to get the bill put together, because the initial bill just said do it. Well, there's going to be a committee put together. I still suggest to the LCC, since they help run these meetings and try to make the documents fully accessible in a timely manner, that they go ahead and get minute money like they did before to make, as they made bills more accessible. Why not start working on getting the committee together to have a meaningful discussion for the next session? Because if the Office of Civil Rights, this place is exempt from that for accessibility, and I don't find interpretability as relates that's missing in this report that the health department could come back with, because they have a law called plain language 144.059, and it sets also the reading level. But the whole thing is if these electronic records are digital image format, they're not fully accessible for the audience we're trying to entertain. There's only two found in the Higher Education Act of 2008, blindness and print disability. When things become electronic, online, we got to consider ADA of 2008 regarding supplemental aid and services. Not on a case-by-case basis, however, but everybody will benefit for fully accessible documents, including people that come to these committees. That's a suggestion I have. I would suggest that since leaders are going to put suggestions in, they should ask the health department to do a analysis regarding this. If states communicate among one another using 508 and web content accessibility guidelines, because of the stuff is an only image format, how is it good for the people that are blind and people with print disabilities? Functionally, it needs to be accessible somehow. And if they're going to make it, let's make it accessible in the front end, not the back end, because everybody will benefit from this. Now that data can communicate with one another better for analysis and comprehensive evaluations. Those are my suggestions. I do ask that the documents currently online be made fully accessible. However, the one page I talked about, page 26, when you use the Adobe Reader for that, when it reads and it gets to a number, it's my understanding for understandability, once you get to that footnote, it should go down to the footnote, read it out loud, go back to the paragraph. So just think of it as a continual reading piece, but currently that document does not do that on any of the pages. Also, the PowerPoint presentation under all the headers, it's been tagged, meaning the images do read out loud, but the second part of the sentence does not read out loud on your PowerPoint. And I appreciate the individual here today that frankly spoke out loud some of the information, which usually is not done at the legislature, because that's up to the individuals to review and pre-review ahead of time, so when they come, they can put their two bits in here. Everybody needs to know about functionality, and I feel I have an obligation to provide that. If you want to try the Adobe Reader, which is a required default software, and see how it reads out loud, you'll understand it better, because a silent read is one thing, to hear and see it is another. I appreciate you taking this testimony. I do consider coordinating of care would be included this. When you think about how do you coordinate care, well, obviously it's about not just the privacy, but how about the accessibility and functionality of it? Because the word electronic is not defined in the statute. And anytime we cross the line online electronic, what are we doing for the large majority of people that are only identified in the higher education area that are blind and print disabled? Thank you for this opportunity to speak, and hopefully you'll find some usefulness in the future for everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Any questions for Mr. Heller? Seeing none. I also wanted to bring folks' attention. Also handed out today was, it says part one, questions and answers at the top, and all the citings for the citations for the information provided today are in that packet. So with that, members, watch your email for the July meeting. Likely, I'm kind of looking at July 23rd, but if the majority of you can't be here on July 23rd, I'd appreciate letting Sally know that, or myself, whichever is convenient for you. With that, we are adjourned.